Well, I try to be as eclectic as possible and do topics all over the spectrum. So we did the history of Christian colleges the first night. Last night I attempted to do Russia. I began by saying I really haven't done all my homework on Russia. But I laid that out there enough that I think you could take it and run with it if you want to know more about that. Now this one is Campbell, and I'm fascinated by this for this reason. What I'm about to show you now, a lot of historians think Campbell was never the same after this journey. And I've thought about that a lot. I don't agree with that. I think we're picking up Campbell now at the age of 59, and the six famous debates are over, his big six debates, they're in the past. The Christian Baptist years, they're in the past. The Millennial Harbinger, he's now been editing 17 years. It's the dominant paper in the Brotherhood. Bethany College, he got started. He announced it in 1840. The students arrived November 1, 1841. It's been going great for 6 years. So a lot of things that he's done are in the past. But the decade of the 1850s, he is still very active. And, you know, he has 44 long preaching tours in his life because he lives in a time when, you know, you can't fly anywhere. And so it takes him, when he leaves to go on a preaching tour, he'll be gone 6 months, sometimes 9 months. And but some of those tours were in the 1850s. And he goes back to Missouri. And he's preaching in state houses. Like, he preaches to the governor and all the legislature in Indiana. And then he does that for Missouri. It's because members of the church were key. In some cases, they were the governor or key senators in those, and they invite him to come and preach. I think when he preached in Washington, D.C., that was when Buchanan was president. That was yet to come. That was in the 50s. So some of the most exciting things he does are still yet to come, especially after the campus burns. Because when those buildings burn in 57, he recognizes, this is 4 years before the Civil War, he recognizes, I can't go north and raise money. Even though I'm north of the Mason-Dixon line and I'm in this little panhandle of West Virginia and I'm only 30 miles from Pittsburgh, I am perceived as a Southerner, and we're perceived as a Southern school, and he heads south and raises money and builds Old Main, which is still there. That is, and I spoke there last April, a little over a year ago. I taught some classes at Bethany College. The Disciples of Christ Historical Society has now moved to Bethany. They asked if I would give two lectures. I gave two lectures, including the one I'm about to give now. And the Bethany Church asked me if I would stay over and preach. I was leaving on Saturday night. And so I stayed over and preached, and that's Disciples of Christ. And from there, I drove to Ohio Valley University, our school, and the Bible lectures opened on Sunday night. So I did, I think, 10 talks on that trip. I did 5 at Bethany College and 5 at Ohio Valley. I went from Disciples of Christ to Churches of Christ, who are only about 2 hours apart, and in the same state, West Virginia. So that was a fun tour. I felt I was meeting a lot of people for the first time. And I did this material on Campbell, and that, boy, that building, Old Main, it's still there, and it's renovated, and it's glorious. The president, she's a woman at Bethany College. She lives in Pendleton's old house. It's called Pendleton Heights. And that was there at the time we're talking about tonight. And the old Church of Christ, which is now, it's usually kept locked, but I've spoken inside it for events, that was opened in 1852. So that is still to come. I mean, we're talking about 1847 tonight, and the old Brush Run Church is going to move into town and build that building in 1852 right there above Buffalo Creek. One reason people think that Campbell was never the same is that we're looking tonight at the period where Wycliffe dies. Campbell has 14 children, most are daughters, clearly the child that had his academic brilliance, who was going to succeed him, who was going to be the next leader in the, or one of the leaders in the movement, was Wycliffe. Named for John Wycliffe, the great reformer. And Wycliffe drowns at the age of 10 while Campbell is on this journey. And he doesn't get this word until the ship docks at Boston. And there's a man there who's been hired to deliver this sad message. And he comes to Campbell without a word. He knows what he looks like. And he hands him the envelope and he disappears. And then Campbell has to read that his hope for the future, the boy that had all of his brilliance, Wycliffe, has drowned at the age of 10. When Campbell died on March 4, 1866, Wycliffe would have been 28, he would have turned 29 in June. Would he have survived the Civil War? I mean, his brother, Alexander Campbell Jr., fought for the Confederate, I don't think he was killed, but he fought in the Confederate Army. Would Wycliffe had fought with the Confederates, would he have been killed in that horrible war? But let's say he survived. At the age of 28, when he sat at his father's bedside as he was dying on March the 4th, what kind of leader would he have been? And would he have edited the Millennial Harbinger? It only lasted 4 more years. Pendleton edited it. Would he have had the oratorical skill? Would he have been a great speaker? Would he have had the academic brilliance? Would he have been able to write the next generation's theology of the movement? When Robert Milligan was writing Scheme of Redemption, would Wycliffe have written Scheme of Redemption? Or would he have disagreed with that and written a different way of seeing theology? All those questions we don't know the answer to, but that's sort of what's happening tonight in this four-month journey. Now, these first slides you saw on Friday night, so I'm going to go pretty quick. So here's the famous painting of Campbell by James Bogle in Philadelphia. I'm trying to think, what year is this? So it's been claimed that this was 1837 at the time of the Purcell debate. Campbell would have been 49. I guess that's possible that this could have been at the time of the Purcell debate. This is the most famous painting of Campbell. When you come to the Rushford Center where I work, I have museum lighting around my mahogany wood, and I have 5 areas where the light is there. And I have this Campbell portrait, and I have the famous Barton Stone portrait. When you come up to the second floor of Payson Library, and you turn left, now you're headed into Special Collections, and Pat Boone gave us $2 million, so it's called the Boone Special Collections. And as you round, you can see my area way down there. I have the only books on the second floor. The books are down the first floor. Second floor is the dean's offices and all of our display areas, it's just a whole different atmosphere up there. But you can look down there and wonder, what is all that mahogany down there? Because I don't have a room like I used to have with doors that lock. And I'm sort of glad. I mean, I had that for from 2009. I had it for about 5 years. But nobody ever came in. Now I'm in the most beautiful area of the library. Students are studying there from 7 a.m. till 3 in the morning. The library is open 20 hours every day, and we're only closed for 4 hours. And everybody makes a beeline. There have been articles in the school paper and the school magazine where students have said that's their favorite area, and they try to get down there and get one of those spots in the mahogany area. Well, I have the light there on Campbell and the light on Stone, and as you round that corner, that's the first thing you see. Way down there at the end of the hall, you think, who are those guys? So Campbell and Stone are prominent on the second floor because of museum lighting. When you get down, then you see the other museum lighting is the original class at Pepperdine, 1937. But this will rotate out, and then the next one is the second class, 1938. And then what is my fifth one? I've got those two. Oh, and then I have, when you first walk in, we have museum lighting on the histories of Pepperdine. Bill Banowski's book, The Malibu Miracle, George Pepperdine's book, Faith is My Fortune, his autobiography, because he dies broke. His only fortune is his faith. He's given everything, you know, to the school. He doesn't even own the house he dies in. And the school pays for his funeral. I go over there to his grave occasionally and wipe it off and pull the weeds. And this man got the idea of dying broke from A.M. Burton, who was the money behind Lipscomb. And Lipscomb said to him, "Brother Pepperdine, people like you and me, we need to give and give and give, and in the end, we need to give it all. We're not taking it with us. We need to die broke." He had never thought of that. And anyway, so we got this museum lighting, and anyway, there's Campbell represented in my library now. Here's Campbell's home. He didn't have a cent to his name. He married the only daughter of John Brown, and John Brown owned this mansion, and John Brown said, "Please don't take my baby away. I'll give you the house. I'll take a room. But don't take my baby away. Don't move over to Pittsburgh or somewhere. She's all I got." So Campbell inherited the mansion, and it's now on the National Register of Historic Places. It could never be torn down. It can never be painted anything but what it looks like here. And it's worth the tour. They give tours all day long there. People come by to see the Campbell mansion. And then he built his study out in the yard, the octagonal study where he writes all of his books and edits his papers. And the photograph of him sitting inside that octagonal study with all of his books around him. Campbell, a little bit younger. Now, he's going to go to the British Isles, and he arrives in at the end of May. He takes one brother with him, James Henshaw, a member of the church in Pennsylvania. Good to have somebody to talk to. And he's going to write letters back. He ends up writing about 46 letters. And he writes that he can't write to everybody. He writes to one person, Clorinda, his daughter, because she will show them to her mother and to everybody else. And then they'll all be published in the Millennial Harbinger. So when I was working on this, I just went through the Millennial Harbinger and just copied every one to try to follow his itinerary, where all he was going. Absolutely fascinating. Because obviously, you know, he comes in here at Liverpool, and his headquarters are going to be right here around Chester. But he'll end up in London, although when he preaches here at Leicester and at Nottingham, these are crowds of 2,000. He doesn't get 2,000 in London. Our church wasn't that big in London. But while he's in London, on the spur of the moment, he goes to Paris. Now, he didn't know anybody in Paris, and he's not going to preach in Paris. He just wanted to say he had gotten there. So he gets on a train and goes to Paris and spends a night, maybe two nights, and rushes back to London. But he starts here in this area, and he preaches then in the Midlands, and he comes down to London. Then he starts back up, and he gets all the way back up into Scotland, and he preaches to a big crowd in Edinburgh. He preaches in the Waterloo Rooms. And it is so packed, and there are descriptions of that night. You know, he preaches about 3 hours, and the people have been waiting to hear him. And there's some marvelous descriptions of that. But then he goes up from Edinburgh, and he does this area up here. He preaches in Kirkcaldy, K-I-R-K-C-A-L-D-Y. It looks like Kirk, the word for church. Caldy, C-A-L-D-Y, but pronounced by the Scots, Kirkcaldy. And I've been asked for years, "Did you ever preach behind that pulpit where Campbell preached?" And I never had, and a lot of people said to me, "Well, I have, you know." they invited me to preach there. And I was invited, and I always intended to do that. I thought it was going to be like a European pulpit. Anyway, the church there in Kirkcaldy decided last year they needed to move to a smaller building. They're down to very few members. And they knew historically I had an interest in that pulpit. And so they wrote me and said, "Do you want this for the Rushford Center?" And long story short, it's now sitting outside my office, but not the one in Malibu. It turned out that the mahogany room and the museum lighting and all of that, there was no place for it anyway. It just didn't fit. But all my archives are 8 miles away in Calabasas. We have a building in Calabasas where now 250 people are working from Pepperdine. Everybody in finance, everybody in alumni, everybody that does our publication. If you don't have to be at Malibu, if you don't deal with students, you office now in Calabasas. Well, I can get there in 6 minutes from my house. Now, I've got an office in Malibu, and I've got one in Calabasas, but I'm in Calabasas more often because it's got all my archives. Everything I've collected through my life is there. And so right outside that office is the pulpit that Campbell preached from, and I'll show it to you here in just a moment. So the arrows here, I'll go a little quicker now. I'm always going over time. Let's try to get this done. So he comes into Liverpool, and here's Chester. He's going to preach there. But 3 miles north of Chester is Mollington, and that's where John Davies lives. John and Mary live there, and it's John Davies who writes Campbell when he hears about him. As John Davies says, we thought we were the only three churches of Christ on planet Earth. The one that Mom and Dad had just south of Chester, 5 miles, and then the old church in Chester, and then Mollington, where John and Mary were. He said, we thought we were the only three churches of Christ, and we have just received the first three issues of the British Millennial Harbinger, published by Jones over in London, and they've arrived here in Chester, and we're suddenly realizing we're not alone. This is October of 1835 when they realize this. And he writes him, and he didn't know what to call him. Dear Brother Campbell, dear Dr. Campbell, he calls him Esteemed Sir. In that first letter, it's in the Millennial Harbinger. Dear Esteemed Sir. And he says, we're like Elijah. We thought we were the only ones. And to find out that there are churches of Christ in America with between 50 and 500 members, hundreds of these churches, and to find out about you, you must come and see us. So those letters to Campbell, you must come, start in 1835, and Campbell arrives at the end of May of 1847. It takes 12 years to get Campbell there. But Campbell writes in his letter, Brother Henshaw and I got off the ship, and we started down the boardwalk, and there were four men standing at the end. These are his brothers in the Lord. And then he said one man came out from the four, and of course it's John Davies. And Campbell's 59, Davies is 54. Campbell's born in 1788, Davies is born in 1793. They are the respective leaders in their nations. When the first annual meeting was held by the church in Edinburgh, Scotland, when the Little Church of Christ in Edinburgh said, everybody come here in 1842, let's count heads, found out what we got. And they all went up there, and they needed a presider, a president. Who's going to preside? And they said, Brother Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S, you need to preside. And he went, oh, no, I mean, it's Edinburgh. No, they said, no, you get up there. You preside. And he did. He's the one presiding at the very first annual meeting in 1842. And they count churches, and they have 50. 50 churches of Christ in 1842. But then they didn't meet in 43, 44, 45, and 46. What's going on here for 4 years? There's no congregation that'll say, we'll host it. Come on over here to Birmingham. We'll host it here in Manchester. We're ready here in London. Everybody meet here. Yeah, nobody did that. Now word gets out that Campbell is coming in May of 47, and he'll still be around at the end of September. More importantly, the annual meeting will probably be on the first Sunday in October. So the church in Chester says, we'll host it and Campbell will speak. Well, they all come. It's only the second annual meeting, but it's 5 years later. Now they count their congregations, and they have 80. So did they plant 30 churches in 5 years? No. These churches were there, most of them. We don't have headquarters except in heaven. So churches of Christ are fascinating to study because, you know, if I had gone with my grandfather and been a Southern Baptist, I could have written history. My grandfather being a Southern Baptist minister, they got headquarters, got all those records. If you're going to write about churches of Christ, you got to hope there was a Jerry Rushford over there collecting papers somewhere. You know, I do all my research on the shoulders of the people that went before me that said, we better hang on to those papers. Somebody will want to know we lived here and what we were like and what we believed. And we need to hang on to our photographs. And this is the 40th anniversary, right about now, when I went to the Sierra Madre Church of Christ on a Wednesday night, Dean Davis, his house. And I met that little group. I preached for them last Sunday. And I met them 40 years ago, and I said, I want to travel around this state and start collecting our photographs and our congregational histories. And would you want to invest in that? I can't find anybody that wants to spend good money on something like that. Would you trust Jerry Rusher to get in his car and start driving through this state and collecting? And they gave me $500. That seemed like $1 million to me. This was in the summer, right about now. This was in June, July of 1978. And I started collecting all this. And then I went before the board in 2003 and said, I'd like to create the Churches of Christ Heritage Center. And I'll personally raise $2 million and if you'll let me do it. And they gave me their blessing. And I've got two properties, a church building and a parsonage, that are supposed to go into escrow around July 31. They're the last two pieces of property I have. And when I wrote that agreement years ago, it was that half of that money would go to endow the Pepperdine Bible Lectures, which I directed for 30 years, and I want that to have a future. But the other half would go to endow the Rushford Center. And so when that sells, I'm hoping when the dust clears by August, September, I will have $1.6 million in the endowment. I have $830,000 right now. But raising money is not my gift. And I'll get that up to 1.6, and then we'll look for who's going to follow me. I'll turn 76 here in December. I've just signed a 2-year contract. I've still got to organize a few more things. But I'm talking to some key people out there who I need to move to California and be the director of the Rushford Center. And that person will probably have to raise the last money to get it up to $2 million to endow it, so that it'll be there 100 years from now if Christ tarries and doesn't return. If you have this endowed, because all schools eventually lose their, the founder's vision. I mean, Vanderbilt was Methodist. USC was Methodist. Duke was Methodist. Princeton was Presbyterian. All these schools had church backgrounds, and they eventually lose all that. Pepperdine's Church of Christ. And the day will come where that'll seem pretty faint, except the Rushford Center will be there with all the photographs and all the papers that said we existed, we lived here, and here's what we believed, and we've saved all this. Here it is for you to take a look at. So here's Campbell coming in and he's going to go home with John and Mary Davies. John comes out and says, John Davies. And Campbell says, Alexander Campbell. And John says, tonight, you spend the night in my home. We're going to travel 17 miles on the train to Mollington. So let's go to Mollington. Now, who's been on my hymns tour? Jerry Hill? Anybody else been to England with me? We always spend the night, Jerry, at the Crabwell Manor, which is a 4-star hotel. That's been there for centuries. But now as you drive in, you're 3 miles from Chester, you're driving north. As you come into Mollington, we drop our bags off. Then we drive this road here up here to Wells Lane, and we take it to the Willows. And the Willows is John Davies' house, John and Mary, and that's where Campbell stays. But he also spends some time at the Cross Looms. This was where Peter Stephen lived. These were the two great leaders in the Church of Christ. And these were the two great homes at that time. Now, this area between them is so built up, you can't stand in the backyard of the Cross Looms or the front yard of Willows and see those homes now. This was named, obviously, because there were willow trees. There's only two left willows. There may only be one willow left now. It's hardly the Willows anymore. And the Cross Looms was the fabric industry. This is textiles. And the old Church of Christ, and you can tell by looking at the sign up, that was opened in 1876. And I was there recently, took another picture of it. May something, 1876. That was in the backyard of Cross Looms. And it was called Cross Looms Chapel, Church of Christ. But now that building no longer belongs to Liza Nixon and her husband that live in the Cross Looms. It belongs to the couple that lives next door. They bought that years ago and then built their home onto it. And I was there. I was there a year ago right now, and got to meet those people. And I said, I'd like to see that old Church Christ Chapel. And they took me down there. They said, we call this our great room. And I said, yeah, I can see. You can see where the Gothic windows were on it and so on. So here we are in Mollington. So here is the Willows, and this is where Campbell spends the night. And he writes to his wife and says, you must not worry about me, my dear. I am in the bosom of Christian friends in this most commodious mansion. That's the language he used. Well, this is the most commodious mansion. And where was the room where they met when they first looked at the British Millennial Harbinger? Well, it was in this room. And so we sing in that room. Now, some years it's not open. The year you were on the tour, did we go to this house? Did we? Okay. And sang in there, packed in there. That's owned by Michael Riddy, Michael and Imogen Riddy. And they're good sports. I go in there and pack into their house every year and tell the story of old Brother Binion running from Chester with the first three issues of the British Millennial Harbinger. They had been given to him by a neighbor in Chester. They were being put out by the Scotch Baptists. And the neighbor said to him, you might be interested in reading these. These sound more like you than us. Well, it was. He was right. This does sound more like you than us. It's being published by the Scotch Baptist in London, William Jones. And he came running to this house, and they met in that room. And John Davies tells the story that for the first time in our life, we realized we were not alone. Whoever this Alexander Campbell is, we need to get him to come over here. So here's the Willows, and here's the inside of the room where we sing. There's the window. And here's Cross Loom's house now. This is... I knocked on this door and Liza opened that door. This was March of 2013. And Lori was with me. And Lori was, you know, get this over with. Go do your history. And so I knocked on the door and she opened the door. And I said, I'm Jerry Rusher from Pepperdine University. And this is a historic old home and I'm interested in this house. And Peter Stephen lived here in the night, and I'm trying to prevent her from slamming the door. You know, this is a Saturday morning, 10 o'clock or something. And she puts her hands on her hips and she says, the churches of Christ. And I said, yeah. The restoration movement. Yeah. How do you know that? She said, I do my homework. I inherited papers when I bought this house. Her husband was asleep upstairs. I forget his name. Bill? She said, come on in. My husband is having a bit of a lie-in. Bit of a lie-in. I said, you mean he's just sleeping in? There's nothing wrong with that. We do that in America all the time, Saturday mornings especially. Good for him. I'll be quiet. She said, come on in. And I said, well, I've got my wife. No, she goes and gets Lori. Come on in. And we sit in the kitchen. And she tells us about the house. And she said, now I got a question for you. Where did the Church of Christ meet in this town? And I said, well, the congregation began in 1823. And I'm assuming they met in the Willows for a while, in that big parlor room there in the front. But they could have met here in your house for a while, in the largest room, that room right over there. She said, well, I think I know where they met. And I said, where? And she took her thumb and put it over her right shoulder and said, I think they met right back there. Well, she was pointing to her backyard, and she was right. There was the chapel back there. She said, now, that's not mine. That's not connected to this house. And it never was connected. But I think that's where they met. And so we went out there and took a look at it, and you can see where the Gothic windows, where they bricked this over, but you can see. And so, and the rounded part here, here's the sign up here that says May 21, 1876 is when it was opened. So the pulpit would have been at this end, as I was explaining to the couple who now lives there in their great room. I said the pulpit would have been here in 1876. But this is exactly how we built our chapels in the 19th century. Narrow, tall. There are several like this. And then I went next door. So the house next door is called The Beeches. And I met with them. They're the couple that told me, you know, there are two men here who've written the history of our village. And I said, no, there's a history of Mollington. So I called those guys, and one rushed over to the hotel, Crabwell Manor. He got there at 9 o'clock. I was leaving the next morning. We visited till 11 o'clock. I read the chapter on the Church of Christ in his book, and I said, this is very accurate. And we were talking, and then he said, boy, it's a shame that old chapel is gone. They had a chapel over there by Crossloom's house. And I said, it's not gone. It's a part of the beaches next door. They've built into it. He said, no, I live on that street. I've lived here all my life. And I said, well, I'm telling you, I was just there a few minutes ago. The sign is still up there, 1876, May 21. So, I mean, they had written the history of the village, but I was beginning to tell him some things he didn't know, like that chapel is very much there. It's not being used for preaching, but it's there. And he was, when he left me, he was headed to his home, driving right back by that, this. He was driving right by this, which he drives by every day of his life. And so he said to me, we've come out with volumes 1 and 2. So when we get to volume 3, would you write a chapter? So I'm working on a chapter in volume 3 of the history in Mollington, England. Okay, the Jubilee book came out in 1892, the Church of Christ yearbook, because the first annual meeting was 1842. And we don't have time today, but I'll tell you, that is fascinating to look through. And you just see things like this. When I was wanting to see where Mollington Church was meeting in 1892, my wife said, What are you doing? I said, I'm looking for Mollington. There it is, Mollington. Cross Looms Chapel. Liza Nixon was right. I know where they were meeting, right back there. And she was right. Cross Looms Chapel. That was a dramatic moment to see that. And who were the leaders? Samuel Davies Jr. He lived in Mollington near Chester, and G. Gillam. And then right down the way, what's that other town? Five miles or 3 miles, Sog Hall. Sog Hall Church Christ met in Grove Chapel at Sog Hall. And the leaders living in Chester were Peter Stephen from Mollington and Peter Stephen Jr., who lived in Great Sog Hall. So you have a Church Christ in Sog Hall and one in Mollington, 3 miles apart. And I could do a lot of stories. I think we just need to move on. Here's the old Mother Church, because I've given this lecture here before, the oldest Church Christ in the British Isles. This is Cox Lane, where John Davies was born in 1793. So his parents were the leaders of the oldest Church Christ in the British Isles. And then he moves up to Mollington and becomes a land surveyor and buys the Willows. And the Willows is Church Christ number 2. But then, old Brother Binion's living in Chester between those two churches, and that becomes Church Christ number 3. And that's within 10 miles, a little less than 10 miles. And so this is the old Church Christ on Cox Lane. A lot of stories, we're going to get by that. Now, then Campbell starts making his journey, and he goes to Nottingham and preaches to 2,000 and Leicester and so on. And then he comes down to London. He speaks to the Atheistic Society in London. They'll let anybody speak to them. And he goes in and defends the Christian faith. And he writes about it. And they're quite impressed with him. He's one of the best guests they've had. He's not antagonistic, but he just challenges their thinking. Your foundation is weak. You're not looking at this. Philosophically, here's where you're weak. Theologically, you're non-existent. And they're still arguing when he says, I've got to leave now because I got to preach this week. And he leaves about 10 o'clock, and they kept going for an hour or so after him. He had given them so much to think about while he was preaching there. Now we're heading up to Edinburgh, and Kirkcaldy is right there, and he's going to go all the way up to Aberdeen and to Elgin. He preaches at Elgin. There's that wonderful Church Christ in Elgin. And then he comes to Glasgow, and this is where he gets imprisoned falsely. And Campbell ends up 5 nights in a prison. He's later vindicated, and then the man who put him there, now there's a warrant for his arrest, because his testimony was false. That's James Robertson. Robertson knows that his goose is cooked in Glasgow. He races to the water and gets on a ship and comes to America. We've been able to trace Robertson's, he was living in New England. He knew he could never go home to Scotland because they were waiting for him to put him in prison. But he managed to get Campbell in prison. So let's move quickly to there. Alexander Campbell's Tour to Scotland by Thomas Chalmers is a fascinating book. Here's the inside of it. Thomas Chalmers was preaching at Sterling Place Church of Christ, Brooklyn, New York, and I think that came out in 1892. But here were the placards. Robertson started putting up these placards. Citizens of Edinburgh, beware. The Reverend Alexander Campbell, Virginia, U.S. America, is a defender of man-stealers, because they have slavery in Virginia, and he lives in Virginia. And this is prior to the Civil War. Campbell did inherit, I think, three or four slaves, and he gave them their freedom, but two wouldn't leave him, and so he put them on salary. Charlie Poole would never leave. Charlie Poole wanted to work on the farm and serve the Campbell family, so Alexander let him stay and paid him a salary. So the charge was false, but you can see how inflammatory this. Turns out the motive behind Robertson was, we're going to lose a lot of members from the Church of Scotland. This Church of Christ thing is booming. They're up to 80 congregations. They only have a few in Scotland, but they've already got some key places, and we need to stop this right now. How can we do it? And he came up with this false way of doing it. American slavery, public challenge to Campbell by James Robertson, and so on. Campbell starts preaching all around Fife. Fife is that area when you cross the bridge from Edinburgh, you're into Fife, where St. Andrews is at, in Dundee, the ancient kingdom of Fife. And there's a book written by Robert Hughes. Robert Hughes is not well. I was hoping I could meet him. I'll be back over there next May. But he was in the hospital and couldn't come to hear me when I was there this last May. And but there's the Rose Street Chapel in Kirkcaldy. That's where Campbell preached on August 10, 1847. And he preached on faith, hope, and love, 1 Corinthians. There now abideth faith, hope, and love. And being fair, he preached an hour on faith, hour on hope, and an hour on love. He didn't go an hour and 10 minutes on love. He were hour on all three. And people were packed in, and now the pulpit he preached from is outside my office in Calabasas, California. So here's the old Rose Street Chapel. But Hughes writes a book, Churches of Christ in the County of Fife, and that's a fascinating book. Oh, did you see the bottom there? In commemoration of the 200th anniversary of the church in Kirkcaldy. So and there's a view of that old chapel. And here's sort of a map showing where the church, you know, the church sat, where Rose Street was. And this was in 1820. And then here's an old photograph, and there's that pulpit. So it turns out that it's 8 feet long, but it's only 2 feet wide. It's a lecture desk. I was looking for the, you know, the round pulpit, and maybe some stairs that you have to walk up to get into it or something. And it's a long desk. And then it has the lectern right on top. See that? I've still got that. In fact, I've got all this. See how the wood, see the lines that come down here? And then here it is again in another photo. Now you can see it better. Now we're into the 20th century. And here's a lectern where Campbell preached from. But here's a lectern, and here's a lectern where the Lord's Supper, somebody doing the bread and somebody doing the fruit of the vine, they're on the sides of this. But here they had the great big church Bible that laid out on that lectern. And so what I was getting was not this back here. That was just the backdrop. And I'm not getting these pews. But they asked me, do you want just this lectern? And there's another view, a little better lit. There's a couple more. So here's what it looks like. And they had a doily on there. That's an interesting discussion sometime, how Churches of Christ ended up putting doilies on our communion tables. I've never been able to find that verse, but that's a fascinating idea. My grandmother would, she would straighten that doily, get that thing just right, you know. And so this is before they shipped it to me. This was while it was still in the, they took a picture to let me know what I was getting. And there's a picture from the side. So it's only 2 feet wide, 8 feet by 2 feet. And to just tell you quickly, Richard Sharp, elder at Northampton, and I've preached there several times, and we sang at Northampton Church, and he owns a trucking company. He must own 60 trucks. And he said, I'll have one of my guys go up there and get it. If you want that, we'll go up and get it. He said, there's a couple that comes here every year and worships with us in January, February, March. They're from Austin, Texas, Bill Martin. And he said, they come out here and they own an antique store. And they know you. They go to the Pepperdine Lectures. You don't know them, but they know you. And they come here, and I'm going to ask him if they could take that back to America with them. And they said, sure, we'll put it in our, you know, the ship. We'll put it in our holdings, or they called it our locker or something. So he went up himself with another driver, and they went up to Kirkcaldy and loaded that, and he sent me a picture. Here we are loading your pulpit into the back of my truck. And then they drove that all the way down to London, where they hooked up with Bill Martin's ship that was docked there. I mean, he doesn't own that ship, but when he comes over 3 months a year and he buys big items, you know, beds and drawers and bureaus and, you know, cupboards, and so he's got big things like that. And he said, as long as I have room, we'll bring the pulpit back. So I can get it all the way to Austin, Texas for free. You got to pay for it from there. So I paid a truck to bring it from Austin, Texas. And it cost me $500 and something. I think it was $542 or something like that. So that's all I paid to get Campbell's pulpit, where he preached on August 10, 1847. Now, most people would find that about as boring as you get. You know, who cares? And my wife might be in that category. My children might be in that category. Most of you might be in that category. But as I said to all of them, I care. And that's all that mattered. I want this pulpit. And then I got it, and I have no place to put it. You know, I can't get it in Malibu. But we're gonna clean it up a little and get it someplace where we'll give some speeches behind it. It's got a future where I'm going to have some photographs. We'll carry it over to the Rushford Center one time in Malibu and set it up so that when you're giving a speech, behind you, you see all the mahogany and the portrait of George Pepperdine and David Lipscomb and James Harding on this wall, and the signage above the Jerry Rushford Center, da-da-da-da, and all that. Yeah, and we'll have somebody speaking out here. That's in my future. I'll get that photo made someday. And that will be an iconic photo. But it can't stay there. It's just there's no room for it there. So here is Bethany Cottage at Auchtermuchty. Why did Campbell go to Auchtermuchty? Because the Dron brothers lived there, D-R-O-N, and they got to thinking, this Campbell guy, we need to go meet him. And because they were part of these first 50 churches of Christ that, you know, were represented at Edinburgh. And they went over there in the 1830s. One of them went, just one, went in 1830, knocked on Campbell's door in Bethany, West Virginia. It wasn't West Virginia then, Bethany, Virginia. And stayed for a couple of weeks and learned from Campbell, and then came back and named his home Bethany Cottage. And then Campbell got to preach in Bethany College in 1840 and met the Dron brothers again. And then he goes to the necropolis, the famous cemetery. This is on Monday, September 6th. And he said it was one of the greatest days of my life. I was remembering 40 years before when I was a student here in Glasgow. All these great monuments to the great people of the past. And while he was going through that, the sheriff arrived and said, I have a warrant for your arrest. We understand you're about to go to Ireland to leave the country, and we can't have you leaving the country. And James Robertson has filled out a warrant for your arrest. He says you owe him £500,000. Well, what was £500,000? Anyway, it was a trumped-up charge. But every member of the church said, let us pay your bail. You don't want to stay in that awful jail. That it's cold. You're 59 years old. And I think Campbell should have taken them up on it. But he was stubborn. He said, but I'm not guilty of anything. And I think this will help the cause. I think these are honest people. They'll arrive at a decision. I think I go to jail. And then I'll be vindicated. And the publicity will be positive for our movement. Looking back, I think that was probably a mistake. But here's the jail, Duke Street Prison, where Campbell was incarcerated for 5 nights, September 6 through 10, Monday through Friday. He was let go on Saturday. And it was an awful prison. When you come out to the front door, though, you can look down and see Glasgow Cathedral. I mean, this is old Glasgow. And all the women came and brought him blankets, and they brought him food. And there were 11 people in his cell, little tiny cell, almost the entire day, all 5 days. He had one piece of carpet that was 4 feet by 2 feet, where he could at least put his feet, because that cold floor was a killer. And there was a cot, there was one little chair, quite small, and one very small table. And he toughed it out for 5 nights. But when he got out on Saturday, he went to church the next morning, and he did speak, but he wasn't strong. But that night, the city hall, they were there to hear Campbell, thousands. And he couldn't even get, by Sunday night, he couldn't get anything out of his throat. A doctor came up and examined him, and then he went to the podium, and he said, "I'm very sorry to tell you, but this man is not physically well enough to give this talk. I don't know much about you people or about him, but I'm a medical doctor, and he's going to bed." And so that he missed these great opportunities to preach because of those 5 nights. But he went on to Ireland then, and he got to do the last part of his journey. Now, I'll close with this because we need to wrap up. On the night, and tell me if you understand this. I don't, but I don't deny it. On Saturday, September 4, back home in Bethany, Wycliffe said to his mom, "Can I go swimming in Buffalo Creek?" And he went with two of the students from Bethany College. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he dove off, and he got disoriented underneath, and they lost track of him, and he drowned. And they ran to get his mother. She came. They finally found his body. W.K. Pendleton worked over him for hours. Robert Richardson, the doctor, was sent for. He came with the bellows, and they were trying to push, you know, the bellow, push that air into his lung, trying to expand his lungs. Pendleton worked on him for 2 hours. Richardson worked on him for about 3 hours. It happened at 4, 5 hour time difference. That night, staying at the home of Brother Patton, Campbell tells him the next morning, "I've had a horrible night. Around 9 o'clock, I had the horrible feeling that something bad had happened back home. I don't know what, but something bad, there's been a tragedy, and I had trouble sleeping." He's telling him on Sunday morning before he goes to preach at the Paisley Church in Glasgow. And this man, Patton, writes this. I mean, he writes home to Campbell's wife to say, "It was the strangest thing, your husband talking about this." And he was convinced something had happened. Well, something had happened. The boy, the drowning was at 4 in the afternoon, which would have been 9 o'clock in the evening. And they worked on him for hours, which would have been all the way to midnight and beyond. And Campbell is in Scotland, and this is happening in America. I don't doubt this, but I don't understand paranormal kinds of thing. I don't understand it, but I'm not a critic. And I'm not saying, boy, did Campbell make something up there. He didn't. I mean, he told Brother Patton something has happened. And he didn't find out until he got off that ship in Boston and got that letter that Wycliffe. And so here's Wycliffe's grave in the Campbell Cemetery. Wycliffe Ewing Campbell, and he was 10 years old. There's the Campbell Cemetery across the road from the Bethany Mansion. And, of course, Alexander's grave. And his father buried beside him. So there's the old two buildings he came back to, but they burned in 57. And then he was able to build Old Main. He raised the money and built Old Main. And so here's here's the four shots of Campbell. Campbell with the unkempt hair, and then Campbell's combed his hair, and then the famous portrait painted by James Bogle in Philadelphia in 1837, and then Campbell with the white beard, getting toward the end of his life. Now I'm just going to go down here, see if I can find it. This building is still standing on the campus. Here's another view of Campbell. Let's see, I'm going to get past. I wanted to show you. Here's the pulpit I thought I might get. This is Thomas Campbell's pulpit that Abilene Christian got. Remember this? And Ed Enzer went over there and talked to the Presbyterian Church. If you don't want this, we want it. And we'll pay to have it shipped to Abilene, Texas. And so there's that pulpit. And the first person to get to preach on the opening night of the Pepperdine Bible Lectures was me, but they didn't tell me until I walked into Moody Coliseum that night. So here I am at the opening night of the lectures in 1986, getting to preach from Thomas Campbell's pulpit. And so when the church at Kirkcaldy said, "Do you want Alexander Campbell's pulpit?" I thought it was going to sort of be like this wraparound. Anyway, instead, I get this long desk, but I wanted you to see that. When I preached for my last night, after doing the Bible lectures 30 years, May 4, 2012, 6 years ago, the brother that teaches restoration history at Heritage University, Wayne Kilpatrick, he went down to somewhere in, where's the bridge where they had the famous march across the bridge? Selma. The old Disciples of Christ Church in Selma had the pulpit where Campbell preached when he went there in 1855. And Wayne bought it. And he said, they wouldn't let me just buy the pulpit. I had to buy two other pieces of furniture that I didn't want. That were sort of a part. But he wanted that pulpit. Then he got a guy, and I'm going to forget the name. What was his name?
Travis Harmon.
You're right. How'd you know that?
He's a
Travis Harmon put that in the back of his truck and drove for 4 days to California so I could preach behind that pulpit. And they came in that day. I was preaching that night at 7. Travis, I said, how'd you, you know, keep from anybody stealing that? And he said, well, if anybody wanted to steal that old pulpit, they could have. I had to stay in motels, you know. And he said, it was parked outside my motel room, but who would want it? And he got to Malibu, and then he told the guys, this is, Jerry's going to preach behind this. They got it in, got it up on the stage. Well, I walked in that night, and I'm nervous, you know. 5,000 people that final night were packed into Firestone. And I thought that pulpit looked funny. That's not the one we usually have up there. But, and then Andy Benton got up and said, well, we did a little something special for Jerry. He's into historic pulpits. And this is the pulpit Campbell preached behind in 1855 in Selma, Alabama. And that Travis came all the way out. He had a ball doing it. Then he turned around and had to drive a week back. I think he said it took him 4 nights, something like that, which means 4 nights going back and to get this back into the college. Well, we've got one last day, and then tonight we sing from 9 to whenever. We start singing at 9, and I'm here for all that. I fly back in the morning. I've enjoyed all four of my presentations. This has been fun. I love this event. Thank you for coming. It's time to go to lunch. It's 2 minutes before 12. This is the first time all week I finished on time.